Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
If your chatbot is a shrink, it might just be time to think. You could be getting unduly frantic, 'cause the bot is being too sycophantic. If your chatbot is a shrink, it might be driving you to drink. Your condition just may worsen, 'cause you think you're talking to a person. If your chatbot is a shrink, you might just end up in the clink. Best to step back from the brink. Don't let your chatbot be your shrink.
Lonely young people are likely better off texting a random stranger than talking to a chatbot. That's according to a new study. Researchers from the University of British Columbia found that first semester college students who texted a randomly selected fellow first semester student every day for 2 weeks experienced a 9% reduction in feelings of loneliness. The same 2 weeks of daily messaging with a chatbot reduced loneliness only around 2%, which turned out to be the same amount as daily one sentence journaling. Research included 300 first semester college students who were either randomly paired with another student or put into a Discord server with a chatbot running on ChatGPT. The students were instructed to have at least one interaction per day in each of the groups. The human-human pairs were instructed to message each other however they wanted, while the researchers instructed the bot to, quote, listen actively and show empathy and to be a friendly, positive, and supportive AI friend to help the student navigate their new college experience, unquote. The human participants ultimately acted pretty similarly in both types of chat, sending between 8 and 10 messages a day in both their human text chains and their Discord conversations with the bot. However, participants who were paired with a human partner reported significantly lower loneliness, and those paired with the chatbot did not. The research looked at college students specifically to try to understand whether large language models could be a scalable tool to help with the isolation that people can feel when going through a big change. More news of AI, citing the need to treat adult users like adults. OpenAI chief executive Sam Altman had last year floated the idea of enabling erotic conversation in its ChatGPT and dropping the ban on such X-rated content. The plan sparked vigorous debate internally over the potential risks. Members of the advisory council of OpenAI, they have backgrounds in fields like, you know, your psychology and your cognitive neuroscience, also expressed strong reservations. Then OpenAI dropped a bombshell despite the concerns it was forging ahead with its erotica plans. When they assembled for a January meeting, council members were unanimous and furious. They warned that AI-powered erotica could foster unhealthy emotional dependence on ChatGPT for users, and that minors could find ways to access sex chats. People said that one council member, citing cases where ChatGPT users have taken their own lives after developing intense bonds with the bot, claimed that OpenAI risked creating, quote, a sexy suicide coach, unquote. This is the latest flashpoint in the continuing conversation about how to anticipate the potential positive and negative impacts of AI in proposing to allow sexually explicit conversations with its popular chatbot. OpenAI exposed fractures over how to balance rapid user growth and digital freedom with safety and child protection. Oh, those. Earlier this month, OpenAI announced it's going to delay the launch of adult mode. But one issue the company is tackling Its new age prediction system aimed at keeping minors from having adult-themed chats at one point was misclassifying minors as adults about 12% of the time. That error rate could allow millions of the company's approximately 100 million under 18 users each week into erotic chats. OpenAI, talk dirty to me. Meta has dumped the metaverse, the thing that gave it its name. Horizon Worlds, its social VR platform, virtual reality, is going to be removed from headsets entirely by mid-June. The shutdown is the clearest signal yet the metaverse has been quietly unwound. It launched with something called Horizon Worlds in late 2021, never found its footing, according to Quartz. The platform never drew more than a few hundred thousand monthly active users, not enough for a project that consumed billions of dollars, in fact, $80 billion in losses since 2020. Mark Zuckerberg had promised the metaverse would reach a billion people and generate hundreds of billions in commerce. Pulling back means admitting those projections were wrong. Meta is now focusing on AI. AI is apparently good for the bottom line of your business if your business is crime. Financial fraud schemes carried out with the help of artificial intelligence are 4.5 times more profitable than those that aren't so enhanced, according to latest estimates from Interpol. The agency said AI greatly boosts both efficiency and effectiveness, making each interaction with a fraudster more convincing and all the more likely to continue growing in popularity. Interpol says criminals can now create convincing voice clones with just 10 seconds of reference material, like audio ripped from a social media post. And the CEO of PricewaterhouseCooper, the worldwide accounting firm, says there is no room at the corporation for AI skeptics, telling the Financial Times. Indicates anyone who believed they had the opportunity to opt out of AI, quote, is not going to be here that long. That approach from the CEO comes despite research undertaken by the very same firm, published a couple months ago, that indicated more than half of businesses using AI saw little or no benefit. A survey of 4,500 business leaders across 95 countries found neither increased revenue nor decreased costs from deploying or using AI tools and services. Deloitte, another professional services business, found similar results of its State of AI in the Enterprise report. It said 74% of organizations wanted their AI initiatives to grow revenue, but only 1 in 5 had seen results. AI is great. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show. And now, news of our friend the Atom.
Clean, safe. Save to save to meter.
Well, here's good news. The principle that radiation exposure should be as low as possible to protect human health has endured at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for more than half a century. The commission is now taking its first steps to end that standard. This according to E&E News from Politico. Under a policy proposed and it's circulating inside the commission, nuclear power plants would no longer be required to keep radiation doses as low as reasonably achievable, the ALARA principle, low as reasonably achievable. Instead, nuclear power operators and medical workers would need to keep radiation levels under maximum dose limits, some of which would be loosened under a draft rule. That's according to three people familiar with the thing. The principle has been the subject of fierce debate since it was first put forward in the 1950s and then made into a regulatory standard 20 years later. Many in the nuclear industry argue it has made it more expensive to build and maintain nuclear power plants without enhancing safety. Regulators have defended the principle as appropriately conservative in light of limited data about whether low-dose radiation causes, like, you know, cancers. Quote, we've learned a lot more about the impact of radiation exposure on public health. It's time we reconsider that, said the chair of the commission last week. Proposed rule relaxation comes as the Trump administration, this is a coincidence, pushes to expand nuclear power after decades of slow or no growth. The White House has thrown support behind the development of smaller-scale advanced reactors, a corner of the nuclear industry that has attracted Silicon Valley startups. It's all connected, isn't it? The administration has set the goal of quadrupling U.S. nuclear output in, 24 years, largely to power energy-intensive AI data centers. The commission action comes 10 months after the president, the felon-in-chief to you and me, signed an executive order calling the standard flawed and telling the agency to reconsider reliance on it. The energy secretary signed a memo to remove it from all energy department directives and regulations. That only applied to Department of Energy sites, but the NRC's move would apply to nearly the entire U.S. nuclear industry, including all 54 nuclear power plants and thousands of medical facilities that use radioactive materials. Of course, this move pits proponents who see it as a necessary step to accelerate nuclear energy against critics who warn that weakening such foundational safeguards is a danger to public health. Oh, that! Sources with knowledge of the NRC proposal, granted anonymity, said the draft rule would discontinue ALRA terminology, the linear no-threshold model, and a 2 million hourly dose limit from NRC regulations. The proposal would further add regulatory mechanisms to enable licensees to exceed the annual radiation dose limits of 5 REMs for workers and 100 millirems for the public. It would increase the maximum dose a caregiver of a medical patient exposed to radiation treatments could get by tenfold. And at a 1960s industrial building by the German Baltic Sea coast, special building inside where one of the former nuclear power plants, parts of the wall are uneven and pockmarked, the result of workers hammering off layers of concrete, hunting for radioactive contamination. It's been one of the most difficult buildings to decontaminate and dismantle, explains Kurt Radloff, who handles communications for the plant. This from Deutsche Welle. The Soviet-era nuclear complex in former East Germany closed down 35 years ago. Dismantling it was supposed to take about 25 years. It's still nowhere near finished and has become one of the world's most expensive civil nuclear decommissioning projects. Nuclear power, as you know, has existed for over 70 years. Out of more than 600 reactors ever built, only a third have been closed. Only 20 have been fully decommissioned. Current lifespan of a reactor is 30 to 40 years. Hundreds are heading into retirement. Even though decommissioning is costly and complex, countries in Europe and around the globe are looking to revive the industry to achieve energy independence in the face of the latest energy crisis precipitated by the war in the Persian Gulf. Clean, cheap, safe. Too wacky to meet our friend the atom. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the smart world we all inhabit. Numerous accounts on the social media platform Instagram, same owner as the former metaverse, those accounts have been publishing glorifying photos of the Wehrmacht and SS officers from the period of National Socialism in Germany under, Hitler. The accompanying texts highlight the individual's bravery, courage, and strategic skill. their participation in war crimes and in the Holocaust goes, you know, unmentioned. This has been documented in an investigation by that German news agency, Deutsche Welle. The posts reach millions of people around the world. Many users respond to the photos of the war criminals with approval, adding heart and applause emojis. Any form of critical engagement is absent from these publications. The dissemination of hate symbols generally does not seem to have motivated Meta or its platform to flag or remove the corresponding content and accounts. Well, they're too busy making glasses that let you record video of women. And now, well, aside from the $200 billion the Pentagon has requested to, carry on our little thing, there's this. A federal arts commission this week approved the final design for a 24-carat gold commemorative coin bearing the image of the felon in chief. Digging in to help celebrate America's birthday on July 4th, the vote was without objection. It clears the way for the U.S. Mint to begin production on the coin, whose size and denomination are under discussion. It might not be a gold dollar. The move marks yet another example of circumventing conventional past presidential practices and even the law. According to the Associated Press, federal law says no living president can appear on U.S. currency. But Megan Sullivan, the acting chief of the Office of Design Management at the Mint, said the Treasury Secretary has the authority to authorize the minting and issuing of new 24-carat gold coins. Said a special assistant to the president and deputy director of the Oval Office of the putative size of the coin, quote, "I think the larger the better. The largest of that circulation, I think, would be his preference," said one of the commissioners. "I think the president likes big things." Now, the apologies of the week. NASCAR driver Daniel Dye was indefinitely suspended this week. That's the second known major penalty of his racing career for mocking IndyCar driver David Malukas during a recent live stream. In the video, Dye was on a live stream. He was opening trading card packs and recalled speaking with Malukas last month at the IndyCar Firestone Grand Prix. Dye said he asked Malukas if he, quote, races on any ovals. Quoting, "He's like, gosh, yes, we race Indianapolis too. Love Indianapolis. And Roger Penske, I love Roger. Love you, Roger," Dye said, using voices that made inferences about Malukas' sexuality. "As soon as I start doing a David Malukas gay voice, I get a gold. So let's keep it going," unquote. Now Dye has apologized to Malukas in a social media post, calling his comments careless. Quote, "I chose my words poorly, and I understand why it upset people. I'm sorry to anyone who was offended. That's not how I want to represent myself. I have some close friends in the LGBTQ+ community," he said, "who would never want to feel less of themselves because of what I said. And that's exactly why I should hold myself to a higher standard." He said conversations with those friends made him recognize that a true friend would know better than to act the way I did, unquote. Dye Malukas, a 24-year-old driver for Team Penske, often posts pictures on social media with a girlfriend. And a hospital is apologizing after recently leaving a patient on an MRI scanner for nearly 6 hours, leading to changes in shift handover procedures. The incident occurred during the early hours of late February at a top care provider in Wuhan in China. An individual with the surname of Tang reportedly underwent imaging, with one attending physician manually marking the procedure as completed at 12:10 a.m. Then he rushed on to achieve other tasks. The man was still reportedly in the machine, remaining immobile because he thought moving might cause him physical harm. He remained there until 6 a.m. Cleaning staff found him. The hospital apologized for its handling of the situation on Friday. It charged that the incident was caused by violations of both work rules and the hospital's shift change procedures. Multiple staff members involved have been suspended. The institution has implemented a system-wide investigation to prevent future such incidents from occurring, so nobody else will be trapped in an MRI for 6 hours. The Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Direct from the Situation Room, not the one on stupid CNN. This is Iran's least favorite president with a brief edition of True Social Audio brought to you by Trump's Shoe Polish. For that floor shine glow, whatever you're wearing. We've had MAGA, Make America Great Again, and then thanks to the brilliant RFK Jr., MAHA, Make America Healthy Again. And now, thanks to me and the great Pete Hegseth, we have MAWA, Make America Warlike Again. This war, not really a war, but was a stupendously successful war, is almost over, although it may go on for a while longer, or even longer. The unbelievably evil regime in Tehran is on its knees, and thanks to our brave and ridiculously efficient armed forces, the best that has ever existed in the universe, That regime has no knees. I told you last June we had obliterated Iran's nuclear program. This month, we've given it a total re-obliteration. And what we didn't obliterate, we decimated. Our so-called allies have turned out to be what I'm, you know, being nice, I'm calling what chickens leave in the yard. We've helped them so much, and yet when we spring a surprise excursion on them, they have the stupidity and the nerve to act surprised. Of course, we don't need them. We don't need anything or anyone. They know we could obliterate them, too, if we wanted to, but of course we don't. Not yet. I'm very pleased and grateful that the Fine Arts Commission, which I appointed to be totally under my control, has decided to issue maybe the biggest and most beautiful solid gold coin since, like, forever. It will have my face on the front and on the back, for the first time in forever, a picture of the best-looking backside any president has ever had or wanted to have. Somewhere on the coin, which will also be huge, will be these words, which I'm so grateful to have written myself. The Great Obliterator. And to the wonderful Japanese Prime Minister, who I had the privilege of joking with here this week, I have only three words. Remember Pearl Bailey. Thank you for your attention to this matter, and stay loyal.
True Social Audio is also brought to you by Trump Pencils. You wouldn't believe how sharp they are. So long. Experiencing, ladies and gentlemen, a cultural change, which it could be argued is the most sudden and drastic since the end of Prohibition. And that would be the transition from gambling being illegal in most, if not all, parts of the United States to it being absolutely ubiquitous to anywhere that there may be a phone. And my guest today has written a splendid book on the subject called Everybody Loses. He most recently was a sports writer for the Washington Post, but that ain't there no more, as we say in New Orleans. But he's written this, actually, as I say, splendid book, and he's my guest today, Danny Funt. Danny, welcome to the show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Let me start with a story that's made some big news this very week about Polymarket, a prediction market outfit, which allows people to bet on everything. And the story is, as I understand it, that a couple of people threatened a newspaper reporter in Israel who reported on either the status of an attack or a lack of attack on an Iranian target. And they threatened his life because his reporting contradicted their bet. Have you followed that story?
I have. It seems like there's a bizarre and frightening development with these prediction markets on an almost daily basis. With that one, I think what's noteworthy is when you allow gambling, which is really what this is, on so many things outside of sports, all these current events from the Oscars to wars to the weather in different cities, mm-hmm. you have to decide who's going to determine the winners and losers, because we know who wins a ball game, but pinpointing what exactly happened in one of these markets where you're betting on more exotic things can be an imperfect science. And sometimes it comes down to journalists and what they conclude. So yeah, it's just one of many things that seems very difficult to regulate and police, and scary in some respects.
Okay, well, let's get back to the beginning. Your book begins with a period of time when gambling was almost universally illegal in this country, and one of the reasons for it was the objections of the religious community. Talk a little bit about that side of things.
So as you and your listeners likely know, a lot of the people who settled the colonies in what became the United States were religious refugees. So they brought with them this Puritan tradition that looked very critically on gambling. At the same time, there was a remarkable amount of gambling in Louisiana and across the colonies from the beginning. You know, people were betting on horse races in the 1600s. Wow. On Long Island. There were reports of cockfights and bear fights and boxing matches, and everything you could think of was fodder for gambling. And yet there was this tension with religion. And that's why a number of states banned gambling ultimately, saying, you know, this is a vice that preys on people, is a road to addiction, and conflicts with religious teachings, not just in Christianity, but Judaism, Islam, and a number of other faiths. So there's been this tension in the United States for centuries of a culture that's really curious about gambling on all sorts of things, especially sports, mm-hmm. and faith tradition that is wary of it.
The probably the incident that most people are aware of where gambling kind of took a space that was reserved for fair play and almost destroyed it was the 1919 Black Sox scandal. Tell us a little bit about that.
So you might have seen Eight Men Out or read the book, or Field of Dreams also deals with the Black Sox. This was eight players on the Chicago White Sox who colluded with gamblers to throw the 1919 World Series. It was such an existential threat to baseball and really all of sports that baseball established the Office of the Commissioner explicitly with the assignment to rid the game of gambling because it had infected the game. It was in the stands, not just fixing games, but there was just a huge culture of gambling on baseball. And because it had tarnished the most important series, you know, in sports, it was a real existential threat to the game. But what I had found interesting was there was a lot of gambling on baseball from the very beginning. You read about in the 1850s and 60s, people betting on baseball constantly, so much so that the New York Times in the 1870s said that paper would have a hard time calling baseball the national pastime because back then it was essentially a contrivance for gambling. So it was something that baseball was always dealing with, but when it ruined the outcome of the World Series at a time when business was booming for baseball and games were setting records for attendance and Babe Ruth was about to come on the scene, it was something that the owners of the teams recognized they had to do something about.
Now, all these people who were betting on sports, where were they placing their bets? With whom?
Through street bookies. There's a, you know, for many years, the mob was behind bookmaking. There's also certain ethnic groups that have a long history. And as a Jew, I'm not embarrassed to say there's a lot of Jewish bookmakers over the years, a lot of Greeks who were big in the bookmaking business. Yeah, it wasn't too hard to find a illegal bookie to take your bets in a lot of the country. And yet, it was something you had to, you know, pursue. If you owed them money, you could get in a lot of trouble. Because it was such a big part of the mob's business, that's why in the 1950s and the 1960s, the federal government got involved with the Kennedy administration passing the Wire Act, which made it a crime to conduct the business of bookmaking across state lines. They also made it a federal crime to fix a sporting event. It was mainly because they recognized that the mafia was behind it, and they saw the mafia as a major issue nationwide.
So at one point, gambling becomes legal in one part of the United States, Las Vegas. How did that happen?
So gambling took off in Nevada, I believe, in the 1940s. And pretty soon after that, sports betting was available. The mob, of course, as we've seen in The Godfather and Goodfellas and other movies, was behind the rise of Nevada. But eventually they had people like Howard Hughes pouring in money. So it had a veneer of legitimacy. But really, for a long time, sports betting was an amenity at Nevada casinos. It was not the main draw. You could even compare it to all-you-can-eat buffets or other things that pull people in through the front door, and then hopefully they mosey over to the craps tables and the slot machines where casinos really make their money. So you could bet on sports since the middle of the last century, but it was not a huge deal as far as the business of casinos was concerned.
When I've been to Las Vegas, and I've done so on a few occasions, I've seen the growth in not only of the hotels, but within the hotels, of the sports book section of the hotels. When did that become just much, much bigger?
There's always been a federal excise tax on sports betting, but it was so steep for a while, it really prevented bookmakers who were doing it legally and paying taxes from actually turning a profit, because traditionally this was a very narrow margin business. You might make $5 for every $100 your customers wager. So if you're paying a steep federal tax, that's going to eat into that margin pretty quickly. But I would say around the 1980s, the business of bookmaking took off. Part of that was a clever bookie at Caesar's Palace invented the prop bet, which is betting on games within the game, things like how many touchdowns a quarterback will throw, how many home runs a player might hit. All of that created a whole new variety of sports wagering. They also digitized betting, so they were able to log their bets on computers as opposed to scribbling it down on pieces of paper. That was great for business. So I'd say since the 80s, sports betting did become a big attraction in Nevada.
But it was limited to Nevada until more recently. And your book spotlights something that I never knew anything about, which is there were these fantasy sports competitions online starting, I guess, in the 1990s. And they were, I guess, season-long events. And all of a sudden, they turned into daily events, daily competitions. Tell me about that.
Yes. So fantasy sports actually was invented in the 1960s, strangely enough, by the owner of one of the NFL teams, the Oakland Raiders. And they realized that it would be a lot of fun to assemble imaginary lineups of players from all sorts of different teams. And then based on how they performed, you would tally up their stats and have a point system. So you'd have winners and losers in your leagues. And fantasy sports became not just a big business, but a real motivation for people to take interest in all sorts of games that they otherwise didn't care about. And the leagues came around on that, especially Major League Baseball and the NFL, which saw fantasy sports as really boosting their TV audience and attracting young people to be fans. Mm-hmm. But then in the mid-2010s, FanDuel and DraftKings in particular were two startups that put a spin on fantasy sports where they said, the main fun is putting together that your roster of players and then watching them play week after week can get a little tedious. Why not make that all you do is putting together your lineups? Mm-hmm. So they shrunk it from a season-long activity to a week-long or even a daily, hence the name Daily Fantasy Sports. And in that situation, when you're doing it on such a condensed timeline, money was a big draw, maybe the main draw, because you'd have entry fees to play in a daily fantasy tournament. And then the hope of winning a lot of money was what made people participate in this. So daily fantasy was in many ways the predecessor to legal sports gambling. And one thing I'll point out, Harry, is around this time, the Super Bowl came to New Orleans in 2013. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just such a useful way of highlighting how quickly the league's posture on gambling changed. Because what I heard was during that 2013 Super Bowl, the NFL issued a warning that none of its employees were prohibited from setting foot in a casino. And then you fast forward to about a decade later when the Super Bowl came back to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And now the stadium is called Caesars Superdome. Yes. After the gambling company Caesars. Mm-hmm. And you've got the Caesars logo on blackjack tables at Caesars casinos. So it couldn't be more night and day in barely a decade's time.
Yeah, so that's really the fascinating part of all this is the speed with which this change has happened. As I say, it's comparable only, I think, in American history to Prohibition. But how did, and I think it comes as news to most of us that DraftKings and FanDuel go back that far, but how did the transition from daily fantasy to online sports betting happen?
The simple story is that the Supreme Court in 2018 struck down a federal ban on bookmaking outside of Nevada. That had been the law since 1992, and that opened the door for Louisiana and 37 other states to eventually pass bills legalizing sports betting. The more nuanced story that I get into in my book, and I'll try to give you the quick version here, is even before that decision, the leagues had been meeting privately with representatives of the gambling industry, and they explained in those meetings how, yeah, they would make a lot of money, but really the thing that got the league's attention was this would turbocharge their TV audience because the gambling industry had commissioned studies that demonstrated that gamblers watch way more sports than the average fan, more than twice as many games. They also watch to the ends of blowouts to see how their bets play out when most people have changed the channel or moved on with their day because the game has long since been decided. And that is what I've learned convinced the leagues to abandon basically a century of opposition to gambling and opposition on the most serious terms possible, calling it an evil and the deadliest thing that could happen to sports. After a while, they said, you know, forget all that. We're going to become the biggest proponents for legalization as quickly as possible.
And you report that not only are the leagues now tolerant or approving of gambling, but they're in bed with the gambling industry.
They make billions of dollars off it, not just through partnerships. I brought up Caesars, by the way. I learned that Caesars pays the NFL about $50 million every year to be an official sponsor of the league.
Wow.
And then multiply that by all the other sports books and all the other leagues, and every team has official betting partners. Mm-hmm. That adds up to a lot of money, but the leagues also profit from selling, it sounds ridiculous, but their official data, which is basically game statistics, they sell to these sports books because you need official stats to determine the outcomes of bets. That is a big money maker. And then indirectly, the fact that it's made their TV audience so much bigger. And you hear about these multi-billion dollar deals that the leagues strike with TV networks and now streamers for the right to show their games. I think gambling has played a big part in increasing the value of those contracts. So I think it's safe to say that the NFL and the other leagues are making billions off legalization, but they're also dealing with a lot of real consequences of that and downsides, because it's corrupting games. It's making more people addicted than ever. Some fans are fed up with losing so much money gambling, and that becomes a turnoff eventually. A number of other things. So it's a real trade-off, and the leagues are having to reckon with that now.
You talk in the book a little bit about pro athletes who now have an after career after they leave the sport, becoming, shall we say, ambassadors for online sports books?
No doubt. So many of them, and also some who are still playing, which sound, you thought that they wouldn't allow that, and then there were some workarounds. So you've got LeBron James in practically every DraftKings ad. Eli O'Neal, Derek Jeter, Peyton and Eli Manning. Gosh, I could spend an hour rattling off those names. You've also got A-list movie stars, Jamie Foxx, John Hamm, Halle Berry. When that has such a big effect in terms of normalizing gambling. Mm-hmm. And I think I heard from a couple of lawyers who were very influential in exposing predatory tactics that the tobacco industry used, mm-hmm. especially targeting kids. Mm-hmm. And one parallel they draw between that and what's happening with sports betting is the use of celebrities and just beloved figures in popular culture to make this seem safe and harmless and like the cool thing to do. And I think they have a point. You know, so many TV shows used to be brought to you by tobacco companies. Yep. And now so many sporting events are sponsored by sports betting companies, and they've got these heroes pitching gambling to the masses. So I think that has a profound consequence. And when we see such an alarming rise in youth gambling, I think that's a big part of it.
We see it at the end of every gambling commercial, that little tiny message at the bottom of the screen that's there for not enough time to read it, but gambling problem, call blah, blah, blah. Has the rates of people calling those numbers increased drastically recently?
No doubt. By several multiples. The thing that worries me the most maybe is I live in North Carolina. Half of the calls to our state's problem gambling hotline now come from parents who are so worried about their kids being suddenly obsessed with gambling. You know, the addiction rate is alarming, and the rule of thumb had been that about 1% of Americans were susceptible to a gambling problem. And now I hear health experts saying that could be as high as 6 or 8%. But what I find is that way more people than have a bona fide addiction are betting more than they wish they were, or spending more time on this than they hoped. And I heard a lot of people inside these companies say that's what they're seeing. And that's got them worried. People who work at the sports books. There was an executive at a sports book who told me, when you think about it, his job is basically to bleed customers dry. I heard from a responsible gaming official at one of the top sports books in the country say there are such powerful disincentives inside these companies to look out for customers' best interests, because doing so would cost these gambling operators money, that, as they put it, anything beyond the lowest common denominator of consumer protections is seen as a competitive disadvantage. I even heard from the founding CEO of FanDuel, a guy named Nigel Eccles, who said their advertising is untruthful because they're selling that you can win and you can't. And to hear maybe the most influential person in America as far as the spread of sports betting say that the advertising of this product is deceptive really set off alarm bells in my head, and hopefully gets people thinking. Because hearing, you know, you might have expected health experts or other people with an outside view of this being worried about how this is going. The fact that I heard so many people inside major sports betting operations say they themselves are concerned about this industry getting out of control and taking advantage of people and preying on some of the most vulnerable customers, that I think is quite concerning.
On the subject of deceptive advertising, you spent a little bit of time in the book on something called risk-free bets.
Yeah, that was one of the main ways that sportsbooks seduced new customers across the country by dangling what they called risk-free bets. They would say, sign up and we'll give you $1,000 risk-free bet, or sometimes even more money than that. And to me, or I'd guess you and your listeners, risk-free means I don't have any risk of losing that money.
Yeah.
And yet it was such a rude awakening for people to realize, no, in fact, you could lose every penny. That $1,000 risk-free bet could cost you $1,000 if you were unlucky. And some people said, how could this be? That's fundamentally unfair. And they persuaded states to acknowledge that. But I would guess millions of people fell for those deceptive ads and promotions. And it's the reason why they signed up. And the trick is, you can get people to sign up for a sportsbook using deceptive tactics like that. But once they do sign up and get a taste for this product, it's very hard for them to quit. So they were able to use that sort of misleading promotion to make this something that millions of Americans now do. And I just find that so telling that one of the main arguments for legalization was this would take something that's happening illegally and allow people to do it fairly and, you know, get treated honestly and get paid when they win and all these sort of consumer protections you would hope for. And by and large, a lot of that hasn't been the case. People are still getting taken advantage of left and right.
Well, wouldn't that outcome necessarily depend on regulation?
It would. But what I report in my book is that the industry was so influential at getting states to pass bills that were written by the industry and as favorable as could be. These states also rushed to set up regulations and put people in charge who knew little to nothing about the ins and outs of sports betting. There are some pretty laughable stories in my book of just how clueless certain regulators were when it came to making sense of online sports betting and how to officiate disputes between customers and these companies. And as a result, the industry has just been able to barrel ahead and do whatever they want. And I heard one person in particular who's a very successful gambling entrepreneur in Britain, where they've had legal sports betting a lot longer than they have in the US.
Yeah.
He said basically, these companies will do whatever they can until they're told to stop. You might say they'll extract every last dollar from their customers by any means necessary until lawmakers tell them not to. And so the idea in the US has been, we can trust these companies to self-police. And if you read my book, I think you'll find that's laughable. And that's just the furthest thing from the truth. So if we want any sort of consumer protections or any real guardrails so that customers can do this safely, it's going to take a lot more action from states and maybe even Congress.
You know, I've observed to friends that one characteristic of American society and culture is that in many ways we're on a pendulum and we go from, oh, no, marijuana is totally illegal to here's your neighborhood dispensary. And gambling has sort of been another example of that. And I'm going to ask you for something that's probably not in your wheelhouse, but any idea of how long it's going to take before the pendulum swings back on regarding all of this?
I've been thinking about that, and it has swung back in other countries. I mentioned the UK, but across Europe, Australia, a lot of places in the world have had online sports betting longer than we have. And so they've had more time to come to terms with some of the dangers especially when you leave it to these operators to self-police. And so they have had a wave of what they sometimes call re-regulation, where they say, okay, we need to raise taxes, we need to limit advertising, we need to restrict the types of bets, we definitely need to restrict the types of promotions that can be so misleading and get people to sign up because they're tricked into doing so. I think all of that could be possible in the US. The question is just, what would it take? Because unfortunately, in talking to experts in the US and abroad, it sounds like things might have to get really bad for people to recognize, okay, we must do something about this. And I heard three hypotheticals of what that might involve: a rash of suicides among people with gambling addiction, which we've seen in the UK, potentially an enraged gambler murdering an athlete because they cost them money. Mm-hmm. I think that's far-fetched. Mm-hmm. We see so many death threats now, mm-hmm, targeting, mm-hmm, athletes from crazed gamblers who've lost money and want to exact revenge. And then the third possibility was a major match-fixing scandal. You know, a modern version of the 1919 World Series. And I spoke with one expert who threw out those possibilities, and he said he's rooting for the match-fixing scandal because that one wouldn't involve people dying. I'm forced to agree, but I think they're all pretty grim, and unfortunately, that might be what it takes.
You mentioned Australia. I spent some time down there, and there was so much controversy about the pokies, as they call them, the poker machines that were basically drawing in. These were not online at the time, but they were just in every establishment, every gas station, every drugstore, and people becoming absolutely obsessed with playing the pokies. So it's a very powerful thing we're talking about here. The book is full of great reporting, and you talk to so many gamblers and people on all sides of the gambling industry for a really great insight into how they think and how they operate. It's really a fascinating book. It's called Everybody Loses. I really thank you for doing it, and thank you for talking with us today, Danny.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
A tip of the list, show chapeau to the San Diego and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead and Thomas Walsh. You can follow me, if you so desire, at substack.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Changes Easy Radio Network. So long from the Crescent City.